accession number 15111, reel 5.
Wing Commander Higginson, reel 5.
So we dropped into this this sewer. There was no what have you where we were sitting, but the pipe went out of it down to the outside of the fort, obviously. So we expected something, some problem of this kind. So what we'd done, I managed by exchanging some of my Red Cross or I say our, not mine, because we each took parts. I can't remember which part each played exactly now. Anyway, we exchanged some food and cigarettes for Hacksaw, and I think it was Hickton, I'm not sure. One of us went down first, and after a while he came back covered in you know what, and then somebody else took the next turn, and then he came back, and we found that in fact one was sawing one side, one was sawing the other. So I said, look, let's take a chance. Navarro, who was a big chap in size 10s or whatever it was, shoes he had, boots, you go down feet first and see if you can kick it out, because possibly the concrete would have deteriorated, or you know. Anyway, Nabs, have a go. So he went down. The next thing that happened was the level of the you know what in where we were suddenly dropped like that, like hell. So obviously he'd gone out, and what I had thought would happen had happened. The concrete had rusted, the grill had been kicked out, and in a quarter of an hour or so, all of us were outside on the hill with the fort above us. We then proceeded very slowly, all of us covered in urinal water and stinking to hell, and we got down to the road which runs along the main roadway to Nice and then Monte Carlo, and before going onto the road we had to go through a garden of a hotel, and then immediately below was the railway line. This was after the road. We ran over the road, and then we got into this hotel garden and the railway line, because that's what we were looking for. Those arrangements were that we would signal to anyone who came off the train. And we couldn't tell anybody then that we'd where we were, so what we decided to do was to ignore the advice we were given and address one of us up in the best clothes that we had from the five or six of us, the one who stank the least, and that was Brian Hawkins. And Brian then made his way down to Monte Carlo and contacted
Father Murder?
No. Contacted. There was an English tea shop. It was called the English Tea Shop there, and it was run by an English woman, who had in fact evacuated because of the war back to London. I'll tell you a bit about her shortly. And went into the tea shop and made himself known, and Patrick O'Leary and his boys then got onto this, and one of them came on the train, and we were looking over this, waiting patiently in this garden at the back of the hotel. We were hidden, of course, by plants and trees and things, but you could see over the hill into the railway station and the railway line itself. And then the train came, stopped. Next minute later, somebody, we knew that the contact had been made. So we went down onto the railway line, and we were picked up and taken off to Monte Carlo, and we rested, put in this flat owned by an English, the lady who owned the Scotch Tea House in Monte Carlo was a lady called Miss Eva Trenchard, who died some little while ago. She had gone back to Britain, but her shop there was being looked after by by Madame Guiton, who was wife of the court hairdresser, and she provided us with food, which she got, of course, from the Scotch Tea House. And there is an interesting aside here. When I eventually got back to the UK, I had to go up to the Air Ministry after I'd got back home. I had to go up to report to the Air Ministry, and it was on a Good Friday, and I was walking down Regent Street and wondering where on earth I could get my hair cut, because Austin Reed's, there was a hairdresser near Austin Reed's which I used to use when I was at the Air Ministry, and that was closed because of Good Friday. Came down the stairs, saw a policeman. I had to get to this hairdresser shop. I had to go up the stairs. And anyway, I came down the stairs and said, I forget about it. And I saw a policeman. I said, look, why is he closed, you know? And they said, oh, it's Good Friday, sir. Oh, I see. Well, I'll try again. So I went up the stairs, and the door... The policeman said to me, you can't get your haircut there. And that was a door on the side of the stairs. So I knocked at the stairs and walked in, and there was a hairdresser. And who do you think it was? It was a man, an Englishman, who worked for Madame Guiton, and his name was Turner. And I started to tell him about where I'd been, and he said he couldn't believe it, that he was in fact employed in Monte Carlo until the Germans came. Anyway, we hid in this place in Monte for a few days, and we were given new identity cards, and it was then suggested that I should travel as a priest with Padre Mirra personally escorting me. And I borrowed one of his vêtements, one of his cloaks, you know, his collar, and we went on the train together in the coach, and we'd been in the train. We were going to Marseille now, and opposite me, or no, next to me, was a woman. She said, "Would I give her a confession?" So I had to quickly change places with Padre Mirra so he could take over. Anyway, we got another one like that. We got to Marseille, and we went again to Louis Noah's flat, and after a few days there, we were escorted down to Perpignan. Canet Plage. Perpignan is on the coast, and Canet Plage is the beach just below Perpignan. And we spent a night in a hotel there, and then the next morning we went out on the beach, and we were led by Patrick O'Leary, and we were told, I think there are about five or six of us, one or two more than the ones that escaped out of the prison camp, there was a woman as well, that's about five or six altogether, and we were told, you drop off there. So the one who he was pointing to then hid in the sand and so on, and he said, now look, we will see a boat coming up on the water, and he'll have a signal, give a light signal. This is in the afternoon, you see, or early evening, And he said, I will signal back, and they will all get aboard the boat. So, sure enough, two or three hours after we were lying in the sand, it was getting evening time, and the boat came on the water, and the signal, and Patrick gave a signal, we all rushed down to the water, and the rowing boat then came in, and this was a boat that was run by Polish people, and we were taken on board the rowing boat and out to the other boat, which was a Spanish fishing vessel, had a red sail, but also it had a diesel fitted to it. And the reason for this was that in daylight it would go by diesel and it would go much quicker, but in night, in daytime it would go by sail, therefore it wouldn't go so fast. But no Germans would suspect a Spanish fishing boat with a red sail. But when nighttime came, they then dropped the sail, put the diesel on, no one could see us. We went like, you know what. And we had a rendezvous then with a boat, I can't remember the name of it at the moment. We climbed on board, and we were next delivered to Gibraltar the next day, or a day and a half, or whatever it was, we were on board. Of course, when we got to Gibraltar, arrangements were made to send us back to the UK, but we were, of course, under arrest until we'd been interviewed and debriefed. And we got up to Scotland. I can't remember whether it was Edinburgh or Glasgow. Anyway, it was a seaside big town in Scotland, and I was put in a prison cell on my own, and then I asked if I could I put in a cell on my own, and then I noticed how the hell did I get out of there anyway, I can't remember now, but I got out of that cell and got into the out of the police station, into the village or the town, to the shops, because in Gibraltar I had virtually nothing in the way of clothes, just a shirt, and no pullovers or anything. And going back on the destroyer or cruiser, whatever it was, there was no clothes, and of course Scotland, it was damn cold. This was October, November time. And I wanted to buy a pullover, so I can't remember how I got out of the prison. Anyway, I got out. I went into a shop and told the lady in the shop I wanted to buy a pullover. And I bought the pullover, and she said, look, I can't, could I have your clothing coupons? And of course, there were no clothing coupons when I was shot down, but they'd been introduced in the meantime. And I said, I'm sorry, I haven't gotten any. She said, well, hang on a second, I'll see if I can talk to the manager. But in fact, she didn't go to talk to the manager. She went to ring up the police station, because the next thing that happened was two policemen came in the door, arrested me again. And I was taken back to the police station, and then taken by train down to London, and interrogated, and that's the end of my story.
So you were cleared all right?
I was cleared all right, yeah. Yeah.
Did you want to get back into action after all that?
Well, yes, of course I did. I tried to get back into a fighter squadron. I went back to 56 and flew Typhoons, and they said, no, you cannot do offensive operations, because quite naturally, and understandably, they said, you know all about, or a lot about, our SOE, Special Operations Europe, the people who are operating, the spies and all that sort of thing. And therefore, we can't allow you to do any more ops. So, because of my Halton training, they then posted me to Napier's and Son. Napier's were the builders of the engine on the Typhoon. I went back to the squadron, I flew Typhoons, and there was a sleeve valve engine. I don't know whether you know what a sleeve valve engine is.
Yes.
It had no valves. It just had holes in the side when the piston unearthed. No, you know what I mean? When the piston just came up, said, oh dear, well, you know, the air was sucked in on the downward stroke of the piston when one of the holes was open, and then it was pressurized when that closed, door was closed. And that hole in the side of the cylinder was closed. And it was the first of its kind in the Air Force, and it was very unreliable. So I was sent down to Napiers, who made the engine. They were defending themselves, quite understandably, on the grounds that it wasn't the engine, it was the operation of pilots were using it incorrectly, and so on and so forth. So I had to set up a school there called the Engine Handling School. And I wrote all the prospectus and all that sort of thing. And pilots then used to go into Typhoon squadrons, used to come down to me and have a course at the school, and they'd have a tour around the works and back to the squadron.
Where is the Napiers works?
Acton, London, on the west side of London.
How did you like doing that work?
I didn't very much. It was interesting for the first year because, of course, the UK was new, and I had to talk to people about this or that and the other. And for the first year or so, it was interesting. Then I went I went to see Harry Broadhurst, I think. I can't remember. He offered me the job to form 83 Group Communication Squadron. This was a squadron based at Thorney Island. It wasn't, I formed it, there was nobody there when I arrived. And we had two Spitfires, one of them was my own, for myself, my personal use, and the other one was for the AOC's use. And we had a number of Ansons and a number of Austers and a few other strange aeroplanes, and we had a fuselage torch, which I've already mentioned, which Air Marshal Broadhurst brought back in a box when he came back from the Middle East. He was, I think, under Cunningham, he was in charge of the Desert Air Force at some time. And when he came back to take over the Air Force 83 group, he brought this box back with him. My fitters erected the aircraft, so I had the fuselage torch as well. The only interesting thing I've got to add to what I said earlier was it was quite exciting when after the D-Day operations. Where's my logbook? Right. After D-Day, when the first base had been made in Bazenville, it was decided to get as many of our aircraft as we could over to France. And I flew the fuselage torch, followed by four Austers from Thorney Island to Bazenville, the first base in France. I think it, looking back on it now, it was a very risky thing to do, because here I was flying a German aircraft along parallel with the coast. It had British markings on it, with absolutely no defense whatsoever. Anyway, it was perfectly satisfactory in the end, and we landed at Bazenville after 1.5 hours flying.
What was the function of 83 Group? What was its purpose?
Well, it provided the air support for the invasion, and the close support for the army that went then through Europe. And our job was to provide all the air communication that the air staff officers and their counterparts in the army staff required, both within the captured part of France and right through up until the end of the war, really.
So it was to move the top personnel around quickly.
That's right. There they are. See, Group Captain Duncan Smith, Kingham, Base Eastleigh, Base Airhead, Base B-14. These are the air bases as they were formed in Europe as the battle went on. You see, as we went further into Europe.
So you also moved Brian Kinkham as well.
Oh yes, and moved a lot of people that are not down here. Of course, these are the Air Force people are down here. I didn't, as some of the Army people I didn't know at all, but they, of course they were obviously only taken in Anson's, not in Spitfires. Air Commodore Boyle, he was my navigator, by the way.
Flying Officer Duncan.
Yeah. He didn't like the first part of flying with me. He was a Scotsman, very clever individual indeed. And after about the third flight, we'd taken off. He got up from his seat and went to sit in the passenger seat at the back. And I turned around and said, "Andrew, what the hell are you doing?" And he said, "Well, you take no bloody notice of where I set the compass, so I'm not going to waste my time sitting up here." Yeah, there we are. Right on October 42.
And did this job with in charge of 83 Group go on until the end of the war?
Yes, it did, but as far as I was concerned.
If I can just ask you one or two questions about the Battle of Britain, just to finish off.
Yeah.
What was your attitude towards the enemy in the Battle of Britain? Was there any hatred?
Any hatred?
Yes.
Not in the battle itself, because it was. It was, you know, I used to box, I used to play rugby, I was always in competition with somebody all the time. The Battle of Britain was another competition. One thing it did, as far as our side was concerned, it brought us all closer together. We thought more of each other than we did before. We began to recognize more clearly what an advantage we had in living in the UK, and the last thing we wanted was to be ruled by anybody else. We were, a lot of us were monarchists in the sense that we loved this country and the our king and queen. But as far as hating the Germans, I don't think you can hate anything until you have some personal experience with them. I mean, I now have great difficulty in ever forgiving them what they did to the Jews in Buchenwald and that sort of thing. Patrick O'Leary, who helped me to escape, as I've told you, ended up in Buchenwald himself. I know he was in an advantageous position, comparatively speaking, because of his medical training, he was made the doctor, and therefore treated perhaps a little bit better than the other inmates. But I find it difficult to excuse a people that would put up with what they actually did put up with in the way of Hitler and his followers. On the other hand, against that, I feel as I felt the other day when the D-Day celebrations were taking place and much was being written and talked about who should be invited, who shouldn't be invited. I did think that at least we ought to recognize that there are a lot of people in Germany who, in the event we bombed and killed with our bombing, close brackets, but who hated Hitler, I would reckon, had they known what was going on, they would hate him as much as we hate him. I can't believe that mass of people would have completely supported Hitler unless they had no other option. I put it down to not having a political system which can react to situations in the way that we have.
Can you describe Patrick O'Leary?
Yes, I can. I'll show you a photograph of him now. Here he is.
Not just his physical appearance, yes, but what he was like as a man.
He was absolutely first class. A super chap, well built, absolutely fearless, had a determination to do what he could, all he could in the war, right from the beginning. For example, I understand that he first appeared in the UK after the Germans had overrun Belgium and Holland and these places. He brought a boat over into the docks in Cardiff, and the daughter of the man who was in charge of the Cardiff dock now then still lives down in Pembrokeshire, and she knew Patrick as well, and we've been to see her recently. But Patrick came into the port at Cardiff and said, look, if you give me a commission in the Royal Navy, I will hand you over this boat, and you can do what you want to do with it. So he became Lieutenant Commander Patrick O'Leary. Then he volunteered to go out to Europe. I'm not sure how we went. He may well have been dropped by parachute, as many helpers were done at that time. In fact, I was offered the opportunity after I got back from my escape. I was offered the opportunity for work to join one of these. I think there was one or two special units which dropped parachutes, special
agents
over, and landed and picked them up and that sort of thing. But now he volunteered for that work, and he went through absolute hell as a result of